All right. Thank you, Judith. Very good. So I'll hang around afterwards in case anybody still wants to meet us over there at the table. And I think we had a little bit of confusion that if you want to be on our mailing list, which I never presume the groups want to be, we'll pass around a list and you just give us your contact information, and if you don't want to, just pass it on. So we'll do that during the last little bit here. I've got two parts yet, though, that we have to talk about to complete our story of the Celtic healing tradition. And the one is this beautiful piece called the Anamkara Relationship. And this wouldn't even make sense if I hadn't already talked to you about the other three aspects. Because, for example, when you go to Iona, 2 years ago, I had an opportunity to do a 30-day sabbatical retreat on Iona. And I remember my Anamkara saying to me, "Now remember, really, Iona, the island, is going to be your Anamkara." So again, there's no the distinction between nature out there and ourselves as human beings is minimalized in this Celtic world way of seeing. That the wild geese and the sheep and the sea can all be part of what teaches us. So this Anamkara relationship is much, much larger than just our interhuman relationships. But I want to talk about it because we're coming up to Bridget's Day on February 1st. And Joe, could you pass around, circulate those contact sign-up sheets on both sides when you get a chance? Yeah. So this is one of the most remarkable stories, and this is really an amazing piece of history. So remember that quote: "It's much profit or much trouble to go to Rome and little profit." What started happening was people from the continent, from France and Spain and Italy, started coming to Iona and to Ireland to make these pilgrimages. And what did they discover? Yeah, they were going to get in trouble. They started discovering these women and men who were trained as Anamkara, kind of like spiritual directors in a way. And they would develop a relationship with these people that was so different than the relationship they had on the continent with their confessor. So the Anamkara was a confessor, but it wasn't just about looking at your life in terms of what is wrong. It's also what's right, what's your gift, in holding you faithful to that path. So there were seven church councils in Europe in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century, condemning that detestable Irish practice, saying, "How dare you go to confession to a woman, to a monk who's not ordained?" But it had already gotten so deeply into the psyche of the people. They so loved that one-on-one connection, they couldn't get rid of it. So in the 11th century, they said, "All right, we give up. The only way you can go to confession now is one-on-one to somebody. But it has to be an ordained person." So the Anamkara tradition really took hold eventually, but kind of in the back door. And Bridget, who is this 5th century amazing woman who has her foot in two worlds. Her father was the Druid king, so she was a Druid princess, and her mother was a Christian from the continent. And so she held both traditions inside of her lineage. And this is her famous quote here, that the highest call for a human being is to be an Anamkara for another. In fact, she said, a person without an Anamkara, you don't have an Anamkara, she would say. Well, it's like having a body without a head. Everyone needs an Anamkara. So they had schools in the Celtic Christian monasteries that trained hundreds and thousands of Anamkara grandparents, Anamkara stonemasons. It wasn't just for the few monks living in a monastery. They said this was a tradition that belonged out there in the world everywhere. Isn't that beautiful? But by the 8th century, you know, and a century seemed like they were, you know, zipped by in ancient times, so that's 300 years after Bridget, the whole tradition was beginning to come to an end. And they said there are fewer Anamkara today in the 700s because in the old days, the healers lived for long periods of time close to the earth. So that's John Philip Newell's, again, rebirthing of Christianity vision, that without a reconnection to the natural world, we really won't have mysticism that goes very far. Conversing with the trees, listening to the silent wisdom of salmon and deer, that's where you learn how to become an Anamkara. So it's just an invitation. It's an early environmental movement, if you will, that this Anamkara movement embodies. And this person, this soul friend, was bard. They were musician. They were poet. They were midwife. They were nurse. And they were healer, all rolled into one. So you didn't go to a doctor and then a counselor and then a priest. One person held all three roles for the healing of body, mind, and spirit. So it was a very ancient tradition of training that took, get this, 20 years to be an Anamkara. 20 years you have to be mentored or apprenticed. Now, the average life expectancy at this time was about 40. So half of your life was spent being an apprentice, but they felt that was really important. You didn't just sort of give a person the manual and say, here, go study how to be an Anamkara and now have your business card saying Anamkara. You needed to really, really be mentored. And so mentorship and eldering is an essential part of this tradition. And I just look in this room, and I know there's some young people in here, a few, but I'm seeing mostly people who are, dare I say, midlife and older. The Anamkara tradition was really meant for our age. Now, I'm a great-grandpa. This is about the time you became Anamkara. Because you had lived enough life experience. Interestingly, this wonderful tradition that is being condemned by Rome is being picked up by the Eastern Christian churches. Eastern Orthodox churches pick it up and actually start using the term Anamkara in Syria, in Egypt, in Turkey, and in Greece, and in Russia. They start using the term Anamkara because it's very close to the Orthodox tradition of spiritual relationship. And once you have an Anamkara, like St. John Cassian says here, that relationship exists beyond the grave. That relationship doesn't end when your Anamkara dies. So, you know how we often take wedding vows, till death do us part? In the Anamkara tradition, 7 years after the death of your beloved, you can get remarried to that person who has died, not till death do us part, but for eternity. There was a marriage for eternity. It was interesting, last year was my wife, would have been our 25th wedding anniversary, and so that was the ceremony that we had. And it was a beautiful kind of thing. And so the wedding ring stays on because that's the relationship. So very, very different ways about seeing relationship that doesn't end at death, but that can continue afterwards. Now, I bet you there's some widows and widowers in the room who maybe can relate to that. So here she is. This is probably what Bridget actually looked like, a fiery redhead. She was a druid princess. Her name, Bridget, Bridge, means fiery arrow. So on the Enneagram, this is an 8 on the Enneagram. Powerful woman. Powerful healer. She was the druid goddess, the feminine trinity, the three faces of the creativity of the divine. That's how she was honored in druid times. And then she becomes a saint in the Western Christian tradition. But she's the same person. She is the goddess made saint. And you don't have too many examples of that in Christian history. But Bridget clearly embodies that. So no wonder that I find at our center we have 20,000 people that have graduated from our programs. And people come from all kinds of backgrounds, different religious backgrounds and no religious backgrounds. And they can find in the Celtic language spirituality something that they can relate to. If you're Catholic, you get that part. If you're Protestant, you get that part because this really resonates with Reformation Christianity. If you're Orthodox Christian, you can relate to that part. If you're Jewish, there's a huge Judeo-Christian connection. And get this, in Ireland up until the year 1000 A.D., it's a long time, Sabbath was not on Sunday, it was on Saturday. You went to Mass on Saturday, not on Sunday. Why? Because that was the Jewish tradition. And they honored that tradition. And they incorporated until Rome told them, no, you've got to go on Sunday. And they said, but that's not what Jesus did. Jesus, the Sabbath, was on Saturday. Well, too bad. We changed it. So anyway, the last great fight came down to blows because the Irish were the last ones to observe the Jewish Passover Easter date, as the Orthodox do. And Rome said, oh, no, you're going to follow it. And they said, no, we're not. Okay, we'll do yours, and then we'll do ours. You know, and that still goes on in the villages today. They still celebrate Easter according to the moon, because that's, you know, the seasons of the year. Fascinating. Utter radical respect. Gender equality. Rome didn't know what to do with this. By the way, I don't mean to be anti-Roman. I was ordained a Roman Catholic priest. I'm just saying, let's know our history here. Rome didn't know what to do with this. And they didn't especially know what to do with this. Bishop Mel, 480 AD, we have these records in Rome, so we know what really happened, was sent, he doesn't look like a very happy man, does he? He was sent by the Pope to shut this whole thing down. This Ankara thing has gotten out of hand. People are traveling to Ireland instead of coming to Rome. This is not good business. We're going to shut that down once and for all. You, Bishop Mel, with his two very unhappy monks, came, and their job was to take Bridget and consecrate her a nun, a perpetual virgin, in the Roman ritual. So they came to Bridget's door, and she prayed, and she didn't seem upset about it, even though it's a terribly violent thing to do. This is what you will do with your life. So during the ceremony in the chapel in Kildare, when they're just about to consecrate her a perpetual virgin, the book that Bishop Mel is holding burns up, turns into fire. He drops it, and he goes into an altered state of consciousness, and he says the prayer to consecrate her a bishop. Now, what's he going to tell the boss at home? This really happened. And Bridget, Bishop Bridget of Kildare, continues to ordain women and men priests until finally they just hunted it down and ended it, you know, several generations later. But isn't it interesting that tradition is there? So we don't... Again, it seems so silly that we're arguing over this today. And here we have a precedent of it in 480 A.D. 480 A.D. I think Bishop Mel's story. And he says, no greater power than me has done this. No one in the land is more worthy than Bridget. He got it. Well, you know, I think the burned hands did it. And I think, you know. And Bridget, so many of the stories of Bridget are about fire. You know, and she's that fiery arrow. And that's why she wasn't shook up. She knew in some kind of way that she was going to communicate this really important tradition. So Bridget is the first Anamkara. Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. There you go. So you could be in the Bridgetine tradition. All right. Very good. This is at Iona, St. Mary's Parish. It's on the west side of the island. Where they've built a stone cairn over one of those Iron Age retreat house temples. And a woman, a young woman in the parish, has become pregnant for the first time. So she goes into the ground and spends 3 days and three nights in retreat. And the women of the parish, Anamkara, in twos, circle this direction sunwise and then moonwise, day and night for 3 days, bringing her food, bringing her water, lighting a fire to keep her warm. Why? So that the baby in her womb will already know the Mother Earth, will already be connected to the land. So that's how deep this Celtic tradition connects to the earth, to the elements. And that's why when Philip Newell tells his stories about nature and the Celtic nature connection is probably one of our ropes of salvation in this time. You know, he's referring to these kinds of traditions that are still kept alive after all of these years. He told a little story in the book of this sculptor. I don't know if you remember it, if you read the chapter. This is a Jewish man, Lipschitz, who was a famous copper and bronze sculptor, who created this amazing sculpture of the Holy Spirit coming to Mary's womb. It was meant to be a modern Sheila Magig. And then Mary was receiving, with her legs open, the infusion of the universe to give birth to the Messiah. Now, he's a Jewish sculptor. And he did this because his family was saved by Christians during the Second World War, and he wanted to give a gift back. And the church wouldn't have his sculpture. They thought it was too sexual. I don't know, where do they think people come from? Vidy sort of wonder sometimes. But on Iona, they decided to take his sculpture and to put it in the courtyard in the middle of the abbey. And that's where it is today. So it's this beautiful connection to our Jewish roots as well, which I just really, really love. I'm sure everybody's heard of Mary Oliver. Maybe what you've not heard of is that she wrote this, maybe one of her most famous poems, on Iona, on retreat, that she made there. So it, to me, sums up this nature-based recovery of Christianity excuse me, that we've been talking to you about today. You do not have to be good. Imagine a sermon starting off with that line. Stop that. That's not what it's about. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles to the desert repenting. You only have to love the soft animal of your body. Love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. So the wild goose for Columba became the image of Holy Spirit, the honking, uncontrollable wild goose. Because the wild goose does not live by itself. They live in community with others. We know that when the geese mate for life, and that if a goose's mate dies, that goose will not find another mate, no matter how young he or she is. But in the V formation, when they fly south or north, there is a special place in the formation for the widows and widower geese. They hold, this always just sort of gets me, a special place, and they hold a space between themselves and the next goose for the memory and the presence of their beloved partner, their Anamkara goose. Isn't that beautiful? It's all there in nature. It's all there in nature. So that's a bit of why I think maybe this wisdom. I think of our young people I teach all over the world, and I often do this. I'll ask, we've been teaching in Ireland, in Dublin, for 10 years, and I'll ask large crowds of people, how many of you, people probably mostly your age, were raised in a faith tradition? Everybody raises their hand. You can do that too. Yeah? Go ahead, raise your hand if you were raised in a faith tradition. How many of you have adult children that you raised in that same faith tradition? Everybody in Ireland. How many of you have adult children who still participate in that faith tradition? It drops to a small percentage. Now, if you're in the formal religion business, you should be worried. But they don't get it. Just keep doing it the same way, in ways that are not appealing to the younger generations, in ways that don't speak to the real issues of our world and society. And what John Philip Newell is saying is that I think by recapturing that Celtic imagination and what the original Christian tradition was there among those saints and mystics would give us a way out of really the death of many of our mainline traditions. They are. I do literally retreats for Presbyterians, for Methodists, for dying congregations. They see the writing on the wall. And I mean, it doesn't have to be this way. There's something back there that could reignite the imagination of our young people, and you don't have to be Irish or Celtic to tap into this. It's just universal wisdom. Imagine hearing the words of Jesus through this lens. It would be shocking how different. It wouldn't be dry and legalistic sounding. We wouldn't be fighting about the wrong issues. Okay, I'll get off of my preacher's pulpit for a second. I really believe that very, very strongly, and I think that's a bit of what John Philip Newell is trying to bring us. So I'd like to give you one more experience, and then I want to show you a film by John O'Donohue. To do this experience, you need to be in pairs. You have to be partners. So one person is going to stay seated, and the other person will stand behind them. So the best thing would be is to have a partner in back of you, and then we're going to switch roles. But everybody needs to have a partner, so please find one now. One person sits, the other stands behind them. And if you don't have a partner, raise your hand because we want to get you one. Okay, we got a couple of folks here who don't have partners. Make sure you pair up with somebody. There's a guy there. There's somebody there. Everybody's got a partner. This is not an observer sport. You got to participate. No one ever died from doing this exercise. It's a beautiful Anamkara blessing exercise. Raise your hand if you don't have a partner. Raise your hand. One more person here. Somebody else not have a partner? Anybody else? I want to make sure. Only one solo? We have an odd number of people. Or did you find a partner? You got one. Anybody else? All right. Good. So, those of you seated, very simple. This is going to last about 2.5 minutes. You're going to close your eyes. I'm going to play that same prayer, that piece of music we heard earlier from Anya. The do, the miss, the miss, the do. And then there's going to be a blessing from the heart to your partner. Those of you standing, you are going to hold your hands sort of around the head and shoulders of your partner, but not touching. You will not touch your partner. Okay, we'll have no touching in here. Back to my Scorpio school days. All right. Now, do you have the chimes, Judith? Okay, if you can get up for me. Those of you seated, you're just going to close your eyes and you're just going to have a little mid-morning nap here. So all I want you to do is to stay with anything in your life that is not as you wish it was. You wish it would be different. Something in your life that you wish could be different. And I just encourage you to make it very, very personal. Don't talk about the White House right now. Don't waste your prayer on that. This is very personal, so we can't change that here. We can change other things here. We can change our hearts and our own personal lives. So if something in life is not working, some place of pain, some place of suffering, and so forth, that's just what you do. You just sort of stay with that. And don't torture yourself with it. Just be aware of it. Breathe with it. Your partner is going to be holding their hands and sort of over your head and shoulders. If you know Reiki, you can do a little bit of movement or just hold your hands steady. And we'll listen to that beautiful prayer that asks you from your heart to extend a blessing to your partner's heart. And then about halfway into it, I will ring my trusty Tibetan chimes. And then, if your partner allows it, I'll have you ask him in a moment, then you gently place your hands on their shoulders. So check in with your partners right now and make sure that's okay. And if it's not, that's okay too. Okay. So then you just sort of intensify, in this Anamkara blessing, you intensify your intention. You make a heart-to-heart connection. You don't know what it is that they're struggling, what they're suffering with. It doesn't matter. You are offering Anamkara presence to your partner. That's what this is about. And then when that's finished, we'll reverse roles, we'll stay in silence, and we'll do it the other way around. Okay? So, all right. So settle in. Those of you seated, just close your eyes, take some deep breaths. And begin. So take a couple of deep breaths and stay in silence and quietly reverse roles. Those of you standing, sit, and vice versa. If you need to, you can pull a chair up next to your partner if that helps you do that more easily. And keep silence. You can. Check in with your partner if it's okay to touch them when the chime rings. All right. Same direction. Those of you seated, you stay with whatever it is in life that is not as you wish it was. It could be different. Those of you standing, from your heart, through your hands, sending blessing to your partner, just for their highest good, whatever they need. You don't even know what that is. You're just there to be a witness to their struggle. Send them blessing. And again, when the chime rings halfway through, then you gently place your hands on their shoulders. Let's begin. Take a couple of deep breaths. Without saying anything, thank your partner. Just give them a little namaste. Have your seat. So I want to end with a little film by John O'Donohue, and I hope maybe in that little experience you experienced a moment of presence and how easy that is to offer someone, even if we're not in the same room with them. We can send them that kind of presence long distance. That's what the Anamkara did. This last bit, there's not enough time here to teach a whole course, but I want to, instead of talking so much about the wisdom of suffering, I want to show you a little piece of film. It's a piece that John O'Donohue did in the west of Ireland. The pilgrimage that we love to take people on. And he talks about pilgrimage and he talks about death. And of course the Anamkara, that's what the work all led up to, being someone who would be present for you at the end of your life, at the time of death. So I'm sure many of you probably know John O'Donohue. His book Anamkara in 1986 really inspired us to create an entire program. And while he was alive, he died in the same year that my wife died. So it was a terrible loss for us at the center, but their work and energy still continues to be so much part of the deep end of what we do. And if you go to the west of Ireland, you'll sometimes hear them use a phrase, Boshona, Boshona, Boshona Magiv. And I was wondering what that was, and John O'Donohue said, well, it's a greeting that says, may you have a happy death, which sounds terribly morbid, like an Irish curse, but it's not. It's an Irish blessing. It's an Irish blessing because if at the day of your death you were happy, it meant you lived a happy life. You live life backwards from the reality of your mortality. So, again, without time to go into too much more, I'm going to end with this little piece of film and with John's words. And then that'll be the end. And we might just be a couple of minutes over. Is that okay? All right.
People walked in pilgrimage, went on pilgrimage to holy places. Even, I believe, in Celtic pre-Christian times, to holy wells and holy groves and holy mountains. And that tradition is still alive in the West Island. The people come up the mountains there and pray. When we walk into Maumee with a group of people, many of us carry dreams and hopes, and sometimes very lonely prayers for people who are in trouble or in pain. It's a great place to bring these prayers. When we love someone and we really care for the suffering they're enduring, it's a deeply poignant thing to take that thought out into a landscape in the form of pilgrimage with a destination of blessing in mind. To bring the intention out of the room and out of the house and out of the church into the wild fragrance of landscape, plants that in a springtime soil where the absolute transformation can come. Finnish moors, faces into the huge, godlike immensity of the Atlantic. I find something subversively pure out there, and powerful and cleansing, and exhilarating as well. I find the danger of that intensity very exhilarating. Makes you feel small, but it makes you feel wonderfully alive. I take people to the Iron Islands because it's the ultimate threshold and the ultimate edge physically that we're on there. And we go to the edge and spend some time looking into the abyss there and watching the ocean. If you can attend with dignity at the threshold moments of your experience, it's amazing what you actually receive. I do this talk on death because I think that death is the edge that is always there. We never know how near our feet it is.
I think there's a lot going on in death that we don't see at all. And in a sense, there's nothing to be afraid of. Fighting fast and death are very fanatic. Maybe when we think we're going to die, but in actual fact what's happening on the other side is that we're going to be born. In our normal psychological lives, it takes us years to break habits, to break patterns, and to change. But in mystical time, like the time of dying, huge transformations can occur in a half an hour or in a couple of hours. And I have had the privilege of seeing people go from total bewildered shock to absolute
loose, tender serenity. I used to be afraid of death for a long time in my life. But when I had a couple of experiences like that, it broke the fear of death within me. I think what you bring into the eternal world is your transfigured identity and memory. And when I go through that veil, I will recognize those that I loved again. And they'll recognize that it's me. In transfigured form, actually, but the same person. Master Eckhart, the 13th century mystic, was once asked, where does the soul of a person go when the person dies? And he said, nowhere. I believe that the eternal world isn't elsewhere, but it's actually here, now, with us. And the dead are close to you, as your hand to your face, or as your breath to your body. And all that has changed is, they have made the journey from the world of visible form into the world of invisible form. The loneliness of life is separation. Like no matter how much you love somebody and how close you are they and you are you. I think the magic of the eternal life is that there's no separation anymore. To live your life to the full is to completely transfigure your death. And when you lie down to do it, you will be able to do it with great serenity, and with a lovely courage, and a little excitement about where the new journey is actually going to take.
It's been a privilege being with you here these couple of short hours, and we do come back to Santa Barbara to do other programs and retreats. Who knows, maybe our paths will cross again. We'll hang around for a while to greet folks who would like to talk. I just want to thank Judith for the invitation and for all of you for the kindness of showing up today. Thank you.
And we certainly appreciate you and your gift, Richard. We're so thrilled that you were with us. We know John O'Donohue also, and John Philip Newell, so we're all in this together, aren't we? All right. Thank you, Richard. Mm-hmm.